Right, the basic story of the Megillah on the surface would seem to be not that difficult, not that complicated, or a story. It's a pretty conventional story of anti-Semitism. It's not the first time it's happened. An evil king, an evil prime minister, a plot, serious plot, to destroy all of the Jews, because Mordechai refused to bow down to Haman in fulfillment of the decree of the king. And Haman concocts this whole idea that the Jews are a disloyal people. And he's able to convince Ahasuerus to go along with the idea of wiping out the Jews. And basically, Esther had become the queen. So you're pretty much familiar with the story as to Vashti was the original queen, and the king got angry at her, got rid of her. Esther became the queen, and Mordechai was the uncle, and he was able to intercede with her. And Providence had seen to it that even though the Jews were deserving of some kind of punishment, but at the same time, Providence had seen to it that there was a person in a position of power and influence. That's a theme throughout Jewish history, that all of our history is under divine providence. But unfortunately, at times, God decrees a punishment for us, but before the punishment is decreed, so to speak, the refuah, the cure, is already in place. It's in position. So Esther apparently was the one who was designed by providence to play this role. So on the surface, it seems to be a rather simple story of impending doom, tragedy, and a miraculous salvation, and the Lehudamai Sa'ora, for the Jews there was a light and salvation and so forth. The truth of the matter is that there's nothing simple, though, in the Torah, and if you read it carefully, you'll see that there are very deep ideas. And it pays to study it very deeply. It's not a simplistic story. In point of fact, the rabbis compare the miracle that occurred at Purim to the miracles at Sinai. And in a sense, the miracles of Purim were greater. You're all familiar with the, it says that the Jews maintained and they reaffirmed the covenant. That they compare the reaffirmment of the covenant. Because of the miracle of Purim, the Jews accepted the Torah out of love. In contrast to Sinai, where, so to speak, not literally, but so to speak, God turned the mountain over them and threatened them that if they didn't accept the Torah, so then this would be their burial place, implying that at Sinai there was an element of fear. So there's something that's very unique about the Megillah, and I would like to focus tonight, we can't do the entire Megillah, I want to focus specifically on the strategy of Esther. She is the hero, the heroine of the salvation. So I want to pick it up from chapter 4. This is at the point where Mordechai found out about the decree. Apparently Esther did not know about it, and Mordechai had his contacts. He used to hang out by the courtyard of the king. He knew what was going on, as we know. He was the one who found out about the plot to kill the king. It becomes very important in the story. And he knew about it, and as soon as he found out about it, he tore his garments, and he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went out to the middle of the city, and he screamed a loud and bitter scream. Now, this is very significant. Interestingly enough, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say that this is the appropriate response. When Jews hear about an impending tragedy, they shouldn't just sit back complacently, and they shouldn't be so concerned about the niceties of diplomacy, but sometimes you have to go out and just make a loud and bitter scream. And he said that's what the Jews failed to do during the Holocaust. He used to quote this sentence, that they didn't follow the model of Mordechai. They should have gone out and protested and made a loud and bitter scream to arouse the conscience of the world.
Excuse me, but they didn't have a Mordechai to inform them, but they got not to have anything to do.
Now, that's a good point. It's a separate subject. But during the war, information already had come to the United States. But it was still during the course of the Holocaust, until 1944. I would imagine he's referring to the years between 1941 and 1944. That's a complicated story. Anyways, so he came to the gate of the king, and Esther finds out about it. She doesn't know what it's about, and she's troubled by it. And she sends garments, she sends out clothing, so he should get dressed and dress properly. This is not a way to behave by the courtyard of the king. But he refuses to do so. And then she sends a messenger, and he communicates to the messenger everything that had happened. And the lots that had been set, the date had been picked, the money had been set aside to destroy the Jews. And then he even obtained a copy. If you take a look at 8, he had a copy of the decree. So he sent a copy of the decree to show Esther so that there shouldn't be any doubt as to the seriousness of the situation. And it's interesting, there was a dialogue between Esther and Mordechai. At first, Esther refuses to go. And she says that everybody knows that there's a law, that the king runs his kingdom according to a very strict law, and that is that a person has no right to go to the inner chamber who has not been called. And if they do so, then they're liable to the death penalty. Basically, what he was telling her to do is to go immediately before the king and to plead for mercy. Because you're the only one in a position of influence. So she says that I have not been called for 30 days. And that was her answer. So Mordechai answers her very sharply. And this is in 13 and 14. And he says, do not imagine that you will save your own life from the entire house of the Jews. Because if you'll be silent at this time, then salvation will come and delivery will come from a different place, but you and your father's house will be lost. And who knows if it's not for exactly a time like this that you became the queen. He answers that very sharply. It's a rebuke. And when she hears that, then she responds. And she calls for the fast of 3 days. That's always the approach. The difference between our approach to a crisis. And before you do any kind of an action, the first thing you have to do is to control the impulse to action, not to do anything. Because when a calamity strikes, so a person has a certain impulse to immediately plunge into action, very often you haven't thought it through. And you have to recognize when you're in that emotional state. So the first thing you have to do is to make sure that you don't do anything. And to withdraw, and to do tshuva, to repent, and to make sure that you're not operating with any distorted kind of premises. It's only after you go through a certain introspection, through a certain type of a perfection, that you can really deal with the external. That's why she calls a fast of 3 days. But it's interesting. It would seem that at first she's refusing. And how could that be? Esther was a great woman. She's a righteous woman. Why would she refuse to intercede? The point is, she wasn't saying that she wouldn't help. What she was saying is that what you're telling me to do is not a good idea because it's very dangerous and I could be killed. And if I'm killed, so then what good is it? No one's going to be able to help the Jews. So what she was saying was, what she really meant was that let me go through the channels and I'll get an appointment and we'll just have to wait a little bit longer and then I'll go to the king. She wasn't saying she's not going to go to the king. She just said that the idea of Mordechai didn't make sense because it was very risky. So Mordechai said, you can't do that. Because you have to recognize the extent of the danger of the situation demands that you risk your life. The very fact that you're going to go through channels, through protocol, and make an appointment, so Achashverosh will know, it can't be that important. It's precisely that demonstration that this is so important to you that you're prepared to put your life on the line that will get his attention. But if you're going to treat this like it's very, very serious, but we have to have an appointment, and we have to get together, and I have to discuss it, and I have to present it, then that per se already is saying that it's just another issue. It's important, but it's not a matter of life and death. That's what Mordechai told her, that if you don't treat this like a matter of life and death, then there's no way. So when she heard that, she accepted it, and she called for the fast of 3 days throughout the entire empire, the entire kingdom. And then you could see that she had changed because she said, once she understood the point, and she said that everybody should not eat and drink for 3 days, both myself and my maidens will do the same, and then I'll come to the king against the law. V'chasher avarati avarati. And if I'm destined to die, if I'm lost, then I'm lost. She's confronting the reality. She recognizes what her responsibility is in this situation. And then Mordechai carries out her command. Now, what happens next? So she prepares for the, after 3 days, she prepares for this meeting with the king. And she dresses up in her finest. And she enters the antechamber opposite the king. And the king is sitting on his throne. And she was able to evoke the kind, she's trying to evoke a certain type of a reaction, obviously. And when the king saw Esther standing in the courtyard, Nosachein Vienna. That's an important factor in the entire story. She was able to bring out that type of chain, that's a Yiddish word, chain, a certain type of a charm, a certain type of a feeling. She was able to evoke that feeling. And then the custom was, if he agreed to let you in, to stretch forth the royal scepter. And she had won the first battle. That is to say that he did not say that she should die, but he allowed her to come in. And he said to her, what do you want, Queen Esther? And what is your desire? At chatzia malchus v'inasin lach, up to half the kingdom. But not more than half the kingdom, just up to half the kingdom, and it will be given to you. So this sounds like a very favorable response. It seems like she's ahead of the game. Now, what would you have done at this point? Well, you would have sat down, you would have told him, you don't want half the kingdom. But you would have made your request. What's very interesting is that she has just risked her life. And she's gotten what she wants. She wants the ear of the king. And you could tell that he's in a very positive kind of a mood. And you would think that she would make the request right now, yet she doesn't do so. And that's one of the major focuses tonight, is the manner in which she uses the element of postponement. She postponed it. And you have to realize that every postponement carries a very big risk, because we're trained not to miss an opportunity. If you get it, you criticize a person. You had a chance. You had a meeting with this individual. Why don't you talk up? Why don't you take the initiative? When you have an opportunity, it's not a good idea to pass it off, because who knows if you'll... Well, he gave me his phone number. I can call him up. But you know, things happen, and you may not be able to get in touch. Yet she decides to postpone it. And what's her request? If it's pleasing with the king, to bring the king and Haman today to the party that I'm going to make for him. So, okay, we don't understand what the purpose of this party is and how it fits into the entire scheme of the miracle, of the deliverance. But the king is in a very giving mood, and fine. He says to quickly bring Haman to follow the command of Esther. And then the king and Haman, just the king and Haman, they come to the party that Esther made. So now what do you think is going to happen at the party? You're expecting that now is the time. Perhaps she felt that the circumstance would be better if she had Haman there and she could confront Haman in front of the king. Perhaps that was the idea. So you would think that now is the time. What happens at the party is, again, the king says to Esther at the party, what is your desire? And it'll be given to you. And what do you request? Again, at chatzi amalchus seyos, up to half of the kingdom, and it will be done. So here's, and Esther said, my desire and my request is, if I found favor in the eyes of the king, and if it's good with the king to fulfill my request and to do what I desire, let the king and Haman come to the party that I'll make for them, and tomorrow I'll tell you what it's all about. So that is the main question. What was the idea of postponing? She had all the factors were lined up on her side. If you want to say that when he first agreed to talk to her, that wasn't the right situation. She wanted to have this party, this meeting. What was the idea of waiting till the next night? It seems that clearly that the king was very favorably disposed. He was in the right kind of a mood, and these things can change. And yet she makes this request that they come back tomorrow night, and then she'll tell the king what it's all about.
Did I read this? There were two banquets?
Two banquets, yes, yes. Yeah, and that's my question. What is she gaining? What was she thinking? And how does this tie in to the story of the miracle. Now, let's proceed to what happens. The next part two. Part two is the story of that night. That's the fame. Balayla ahu nadadash nas amalach. On that night, the king couldn't sleep. He had trouble sleeping. Was that just by accident? Did he have too much wine? Had he drunk too much wine? It's not clear. That's the story, by the way. The Gemara says this is the story of the providence. This is where providence comes into the picture. He couldn't sleep, and so what does he do if he couldn't sleep? He gets some reading. What's he reading about, though? Interestingly enough, he's reading about Divrei Hayam. He starts to read the history. He's checking on the records of the transactions. And that's kind of curious, because it doesn't seem from the story that that was the normal thing that he did. You know that it's not the normal thing that he did. How do you know it's not the normal thing that he did? Because he comes upon something which had happened recently and he didn't know about. That was the fact that the big son and Seresh had conspired to kill him. And the king's life had been saved because somebody had passed on the information. Who passed on the information? Wrong. Esther. Esther did in the name of Maruch. In the name, that's very, very important. It seems like a trivial thing when he told Esther, because she had access to the king. And he did it, he wasn't looking for credit. He did it because that's the obligation of a Jew, has to be loyal to the country. So he heard about a plot against the king, and he had to pass on the information. He wasn't looking for the credit. Esther gave him the credit. So you see how important it is, that's vital, that's crucial to the entire miracle, is that instead of taking the credit for herself, which is a very, very normal reaction, everybody wants the credit for themselves. She didn't have to mention, he didn't instruct her to put his name in there, but she did it because she was a perfected individual. That's the truth. But it turned out to be the saving factor. So now he reads about the fact that Bichlan and Seresh had conspired to kill him, and that this Jew, Mordechai Yehudi, had saved his life. So what bothered him? All of a sudden, it bothered him. What was his reason? He wasn't rewarded. This sounds a little bit strange, does it not? In the middle of all this, of everything that's happening, and he's had this party with Esther, and he's come home, and he can't sleep, and he's reading about it, and suddenly he reads about this little detail, and the thing that bothers him is that Manas ala Mordechai al zeh. What was done for Mordechai? He wasn't rewarded. Okay, so he wasn't rewarded. You don't think that that's the most important thing that would trouble a king, but that's troubling him. This is a very interesting, the drama over here. While all this is happening, there's another story. I don't know if we could depict it in a movie, we'd have to split the screen, because from the party, the story goes to Ahasuerus, who goes home and can't sleep, and he calls for the history books, and at the same time, who else are we going to be following?
You can read it like this. He's troubled because he doesn't understand Esther's accident.
Oh, slow down. Wait a while. You're getting a little too soon. You got to wait. Timing is very.
I really like to move things along.
Just wait a little bit longer. The suspense is too much over here. And in fact, come back tomorrow night and we'll have a wine, and then I'll tell. Just wait a little while, okay? At the same time, there's the story of Haman on that night. What happens to Haman on that night? In what state does he leave the party? What's he feeling? Sameach v'tov lev. This is the greatest night of his life, and he's in great spirits because this is the ultimate. That only he of all people and the king were invited to a party that was made by the queen. Now what happens next? This is a good review.
He's angered by Mordechai sitting
there. All of a sudden he sees Mordechai. Don't you learn something from this? The joy of the Russia is short-lived. It's very short-lived. The joy of the wicked doesn't last too long, because look at the mood swing. He goes from the greatest moment of his life, and what is it that can destroy a person's happiness? Something which is very, very trivial. Would seem to be trivial, but it's not. He sees Mordechai, and what is the pasuk? The pasuk describes it beautifully. What does it say? Velo kam, velo zami menu. He didn't get up, and velo zah, he didn't move. Which of the two was worse? He didn't get up when he walked by. But not only that, velozah means no response, he didn't even notice him. There was no response whatsoever. That's the worst. Velokam, he could have maybe lived with, but veloza means that he didn't recognize that this person had any significance whatsoever, and he was filled with anger. He was filled with flaming anger, and what does the Rasha do when he's confronted with a situation like that? He can't tolerate, so he calls his friends. He gets together with his friends and his family to assuage him. That's not... See, a righteous individual can have this kind of a experience, a letdown, but what does he do? You try and introspect. You look within yourself. Well, what's wrong with me? Why am I going through such a crazy feeling because of something trivial? That's not what he does. He calls together all of his friends and his family, and he tells them about his greatness, because he has to bolster himself, about all of his achievements. And what does he say? And all this is worthless to me. And every time I see Mordechai, a Yehudi, standing in the courtyard, and he doesn't show me any respect. Can you imagine? An individual has risen to the highest position, the pinnacle of power, and he's gotten, it would seem, he's gotten everything that he could possibly want, and because one insignificant individual won't show him respect, he's completely destroyed. Sounds strange. It's 100% true. If you understand the psyche of the wicked person, of the Russia. Anyhow, what's their advice? The advice is, don't change yourself. Maybe you've got a problem. See, if you came to me, I would say, I think you got a problem over here. Why is this disturbing you so much? It can't be the external situation. It's got to be something within you that can produce such a result. But that's not what the friends. The friends say, you got a problem? Get rid of the problem. Reality is making you unhappy? Change reality. Don't change yourself. Change reality. See, the tzaddik looks, how can I change myself so I can be in line with reality? The Russia, as long as he can change, get away with it, change the reality. That's what they tell him. But it's very, very bad advice. It's very, very bad advice. It's very, very reckless advice, because it's something which is completely irrational. So, but he needs to have that gratification. So what does he do? So now you see the two things. You have the king on the one hand. The king is reading about Mordechai saved his life, and Mordechai wasn't rewarded. And now Haman is coming to the king to tell the king to kill Mordechai immediately, which is very, very stupid. If he just waits a few months, Mordechai is going to be killed along with the rest of the Jews, but he can't wait those few months. He needs the immediate gratification. So as he comes in, and before he has a chance to tell the king immediately asks him what to do about the individual whom the king wants to show great honor to. So, well, what's the response? What comes to Haman's mind? That he's talking, who could it be but me? I see you've read the story. Okay. I mean, in preparation for tonight. So he immediately thinks, again, I think we all can learn from this. You see how a person is completely in his own zone when he's captivated by certain emotions. So whatever is happening, everything that's happening in the world relates to him. If the king wants to honor someone, it can't be that maybe there's somebody else. It's got to be him. Maybe you've seen people like this in society that have these kind of syndromes. Anyways, so in his own mind, he's convinced that it's him. So what does he say? That this is on page 1257. So Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king especially wants to honor, have them bring a royal robe that the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden, one with a royal crown on his head. Then let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble officers, and let them attire the man whom the king especially wants to honor, and parade him on horseback through the city square, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man whom the king especially wants to honor. Okay, so that's pretty much of a giveaway. He's kind of revealing his thoughts and his desires to the king. The king is beginning to wake up from his own stupor. And then the king said to Haman, hurry, then get the robe and the horse, as you have said, and do all this for Mordechai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Do not omit a single detail that you have suggested. So As kids, we've all learned about this. But it strikes you as strange, because let's assume that the king listened to the idea, and obviously he liked the idea, but why did he have to humiliate Haman like that at this point in time? It would seem that he really was not just wanted to honor Mordechai, but at this point in time it would seem that he was humiliating Haman. He could have gotten somebody else to do it. It's quite obvious that for a man of such power and prestige to have to lead the horse throughout the city and proclaim before him, it's not just that he's honoring Mordechai. It seems to me that he's humiliating Haman as well, and it's not quite clear why. At this point in time, we don't understand why. What has Haman done that would elicit this type of response from the king? Anyways, this seems to be the downfall, the beginning of the end for Haman. Because obviously, when you know that he's humiliated, because it said at the end, this is in 12, we're on page 1258, and Mordechai returned, this is after the honor, and Haman was hurried home. Now he had to get ready to go to the second party. But Avel, look at the Avel, in a state of mourning, and his head was covered. He was embarrassed. He was humiliated. He was destroyed. And he gets together with his family again, his wife and his friends, and then they sing a different tune. It's very strange. They said, if this individual Mordechai is from the seed of the Jews, before whom you've begun to fall, you won't stand up, because you're going to keep falling before him. So they recognized that this was the beginning of the end, that there was a downfall over here. And they were still speaking, and then suddenly the officers of the king come, and they hurry him, because he had to be brought to the party that Esther had made. So at this point in time, the question is, what is the significance? What happened on that night? How does this night fit into the entire story of the miracle? Because then you're going to go to the second party, and she's going to make her request, and she's going to get a favorable response from the king. So what's the significance of that night? How does it fit in? Let's assume, for example, that nothing would have happened that night. Let's assume that Haman had not seen Mordechai. Let's assume that Haman had gone straight home. It doesn't seem, you don't see the connection between the event, other than the fact that it's fun to read about the downfall, and it's nice to know, but we have some, we understand certain points of human psychology from it, but the book is really a book about the miracle. That night is extremely important. As the rabbis say, that the chapter we just did is the story of divine providence. Providence is arranging things to happen, so they must be very important. So I'd like to, at this point, see if we can elucidate the strategy of Esther. And she was operating with tremendous wisdom. And she had a plan. She could not control all the factors, but nobody can ever control all the factors in a plan. Everybody likes to try and anticipate, micromanage, to try and control every little detail, but it's an impossibility. Even today, with all the sophisticated computers and whatever, you can't. But you have to have a general plan, and if God is on your side and your plan is correct, then that's the best guarantee you have of success. So let's pause now and see if we can elucidate what she was trying to do. Because we said, it would seem that she didn't listen to Mordechai. Mordechai said, go before the king and just plead. She agreed to go before the king, but once it was her assignment, she thought for herself. Now let me see if I can reconstruct what I consider to be her plan. See, in order to formulate a plan, a strategy, you have to have an understanding of your enemy. And you have to have an understanding of what your problem is. You can learn a great deal about strategy from this story. The Megillah, at the very beginning, there are really four central characters in the Megillah. The four characters are, you have Ahasuerus and Haman on the one hand. They represent who we would call people, I guess you want to use the term wicked people, people that don't live in accordance with true ideas, with truth. And then you have, on the other hand, you have Mordechai and Esther, who we regard as the righteous people, who live according to the truth, the true principles of Judaism. But would you say that Ahasuerus and Haman were essentially the same? Or was there a significant difference between them, even though neither one of them was a righteous person? Well, the Megillah depicts, what is the story at the very first chapter of the Megillah? What's it talking about? The tremendous and lavish party that he threw. So he was somebody who wanted to be the king, he wanted the power, but what was his goal? What is it about power that he really wanted? What kind of a person was he? How would you describe him? He's a very contemporary individual. He'd fit beautifully right into our society. Where would he be living? And whose mansion would he try to seek residence? All right, there you go. You didn't have to blurt it out so quickly. Okay. How do you know about it? No.
I heard a story somewhere.
All right. Okay. You have to keep up with the news.
I wasn't there.
But basically, he's what we would call a hedonistic kind of an individual. He was interested in materialism. There's a good word that we in the yeshivish world, taiva. You know, do you all know if you ever hear the word taiva? Lust, desire, beautiful women. That was the whole pageantry and drinking and the beautiful vessels. He was into it for the sake of the enjoyment of the physical enjoyment of the materialism. In fact, he couldn't even restrain himself. That was why he lost Vashti. You see, it's a self-defeating way of life, because he loved Vashti, but the need to summon her, to show off her beauty, and she refused. So he wound up killing her. Then, after his anger wore off, then he felt regret. But he also had advisors, the same thing. No, he gathered his advisors, and nobody suggested, well, maybe you should look into yourself, you made a mistake. No, it's no problem, we'll have this pageant, we'll get something more beautiful for you. So that was the character of Ahasuerus. Essentially, he was interested in the kingship because he wanted to enjoy all of the physical pleasures of this world. And what was the nature of Haman?
One more thing. He was also a very arrogant individual.
Yes.
And this arrogance goes along with tremendous jealousy and inability to share anything. So it's sort of viewing the kingdom as his.
That's his. For his own. But the reason why he wants it,
yeah.
The reason why he wants it is for his own personal lust. That type of gratification is significant, yeah.
Okay.
As opposed to, as you say, as opposed to Haman. Haman is different. Haman is totally different.
Even anti-Semite.
No, before.
From beginning to end.
Yeah, but there's a reason why he's an anti-Semite, more so than Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is less apt to be an anti-Semite. He's only secondarily. He only agrees to the plan because it's what Haman wanted. But what's Haman's drive? What is he after? What does he enjoy? Does he enjoy the physical lust? Is he after beautiful women? No, power. He wants power for the sake of power, ego, prestige. In fact, the rabbis say it was his idea that Vashti should be killed, because he sensed in her a rival. She was resisting. She wasn't giving in to the king. It was his idea. But when he was promoted to be the prime minister, what did he demand? The demand was that everybody has to bow down to him. Ahasuerus didn't have that demand. And when one person, Mordechai refused to show him that honor, he went crazy. So a person can be drawn to power for two different reasons. Either it's because he's interested in the pleasures, that's Ahasuerus, but Haman was not. There are many people, the truth of the matter is, there are many dictators who are not interested at all in the physical pleasures. But the main thing to them is to exert power and to have the adulation of mankind. That's what motivates them. And some people, of course, are motivated by both, but in this case you have clear-cut types, stereotypes. Now, what happens? A relationship is created between Ahasuerus and Haman. And you'll probably find this happening frequently. It's not just a one-time thing. An alliance is formed between the two. Why does Why does Ahasuerus give him such tremendous power? To the extent that he's even worshipped, all that adulation. It makes perfect sense. There's a natural alliance between the man of lust and the man of power. Because Ahasuerus doesn't want to be bothered with the running of the kingdom. He doesn't want to be involved in all of those details. He wants to be involved in pleasure and partying. You can't do both at the same time. But he needs somebody to protect the kingship. He needs somebody to run the ship. So therefore, who's the perfect individual? The one that's going to be working 20 hours a day, that loves to be involved in all of these details, that's Haman. So there's a natural alliance between the man of lust and the man of power. And that's how this alliance is born. All this Esther is analyzing. She understands that. Now her problem is, this is the genius, however, there's a genius. Haman is a genius. If he wasn't, he wouldn't have been dangerous. He has the tremendous ability to mask his own personal desires as though they were really for the sake of the kingship. In fact, the reason why he had Vashti killed was personal, because he sent a possible rival to power. But when he presented it to the king, he made it a matter of the kingship, that it'll cause all the women will rebel against the men, it'll cause a breakdown and so forth. And when he was angered by Mordechai, and he recognized again that it wasn't just Mordechai, that he comes from a certain people, the Jewish people, and the Jewish people always resist idolatry, and they'll never, ever give in to this type of adulation, so he wanted to wipe them out for purely personal reasons. It was a personal thing. But how did he present it to the king? That it's not good for the kingship that the Jews are disloyal, they don't pay their taxes, they don't assimilate, they're not part of the nation. And it's not a good idea for the king to keep them. So he was able, he had this tremendous ability to convince the king that he was completely loyal to the interests of the king. That was his genius. And that was the biggest problem that Esther faced.
That's the story of Pharaoh. Same thing. We learned that from the Pharaoh's advisor, that the Jews become too multitude of a nation and they'd be against Pharaoh.
Yeah, that's what he had said too. That's true. Now, in order for this relationship to exist, Esther recognized that the king has to have total confidence in Haman. And he has to repress any doubts. He's not a stupid individual, and you're always suspicious. Is this guy really for me, or does he have his own motivations? In order for him to sit back and to enjoy everything and to have complete trust that whatever Haman is doing, he's doing for the sake of the kingship, that is essential to the relationship. And that's, in my opinion, when Esther, perhaps it was during those 3 days or whatever point, that was the way she understood. That her challenge was to break the alliance between the two. And to show the king, to be able to communicate to the king that he had a completely distorted picture. That Haman, in fact, was purely selfish. He was not interested in the king. And to the contrary, the Jews are the ones that were the loyal ones. That was her objective. But what was the strategy? How is she going to do it? In order to effectuate something, you have to realize, if you want to convince somebody that they're making a mistake, and it's a long-held belief, the first thing you need is time. That's why she could not. Had she gone straight, directly, out of nowhere, and tried to convince him that he was wrong, it just wouldn't work. The seeds had to be planted. So she needed, first of all, you need time. And the first time she came before him, there was no time at all. So had she just blurted it out, he would have denied it. He would have gone to Haman. Haman would have come up with some clever answer. Wouldn't have worked. So don't waste your time. So she makes this strange request that the two of that him and Haman should come to a party. So already it's got him wondering, what's going on over here? Why would she want? Well, the rabbis say, is there an affair between them? Is there something going on? Is there a plot? He had no idea. But that was her objective, to plant seeds of doubt, to give herself enough time for these seeds to take root, and to heighten the suspense, to create an element of suspense that something of great significance is about to happen. So he comes to the party, and already he's curious, and he's prepared to give her whatever. You see the curiosity. He needs to know. He needs instant gratification. And she, the genius, was not just in the plan, but to be able to control the impulse, to be able to have the patience to let the plan take hold. And again, she waits, and he's requesting, he wants to know what's going on, and she won't tell. The not telling is extremely significant, and she's forcing him to go for another 24 hours knowing that all these thoughts are going to be cooking in his mind. Yeah.
It's not just a positive he can't, he needs fulfillment. He knows coming into this that she risked her life.
Mm.
This is not going to be a happy surprise.
Mm. I made that point before. That's an excellent point. That's what Mordechai had said. She took that point. Yeah. Mordechai had said it for a different reason, perhaps, but that point works very well now, that it's got to be something which is extremely important that she took the risk of endangering her life to do this.
To invite him to a party.
So that's why it's not by accident that he can't sleep that night. See, at this point in time, she really can't control what's going to happen afterwards. She can't control the fact that Haman's going to walk out. A lot of other things are happening that are outside of her control. But notice how everything is working purely in her favor. That he goes home and he can't sleep. That's exactly what she wanted. She doesn't want him to sleep. She wants him to be thinking. And she doesn't know what he's going to do, that he's going to read. But it makes sense, because there's an element of fear. What's going on over here? It could be threatening. So if it's threatening, he wants to read up all the data, all the information. So that's a good thing. And then he discovers this little piece. It's amazing that this little piece becomes so significant. Why is it that, and why does it bother him so much all of a sudden that Mordechai wasn't rewarded? And how does this fit in beautifully into what she's trying to do? Why is it important that he should be rewarded? It's extremely important that he should be rewarded. Because the king is always in danger. He always has enemies, as you see, conspiring to kill him. So he has his own secret service, but it's impossible to control everything. So what you need is loyal citizens. If there are loyal citizens and they hear what's going on and they report, that's another way of gaining a certain type of security. So it's extremely important to set an example to people, to give this person a reward so that other people will be motivated to do the same thing. So how could Haman overlook something like that if he truly cared about the king's welfare? So why wouldn't he reward Mordechai? Oh, because he doesn't like the Jews? Oh, so that means that he's more concerned about his own selfish interests than about the king. You see, that's the significance of that factor. She couldn't control it. That's the night of the providence. But you see that providence is working with the plan of Esther and is bringing together all the factors that will help to make it successful. And even the very factor of the timing. By the time Haman gets there, it's a different Ahasuerus already has a different attitude towards him. He's already questioning, is he truly loyal? He might have questioned it before, but he's repressed it. But now he's not repressing it because he's got this looming threat. He's got the suspense of what's going on. There's something going on between him and Esther. There's something major. He's read the story, and the story really goes to the heart of the matter. Is this man really loyal to me? And that, I believe, is the reason why he humiliates him on that night. Because he asked them, what would you do to honor this person? You don't think he could have thought? You don't think he couldn't have figured out what to do to honor a person? It's not that complicated a question. But he was walking into the trap. When he started to explain in all this tremendous detail about the robe and the crown and this, what the man... In other words, it showed you don't have to be a brilliant psychologist to figure out that what he was telling him is exactly an expression of what he would want for himself. So when he saw that, he said, you do it. At that point in time, a serious breach had been created in the relationship between Ahasuerus and Haman. He was beginning to look at Haman in an entirely different way. The seeds had been planted, and then Then they come to the second party. And you see, let's just read quickly what takes place at the second party. Esther doesn't know what took place that night, but her strategy was brilliant, and that was the objective. She understood the nature of the alliance, and she wanted to break the alliance. Now let's see, let's just read this last part about the party. So they come together again, and this is on page 1258. What is your desire? What is your request? Up to half the kingdom. And Esther says, she always paraphrases, "Im matzasi chem b'yinecha, if I found favor in your eyes. And if it is good with the king, give me my life for my request, and my nation for my desire." Bakashasi. This is extremely important. We're not doing the whole story, but as you will be reading the story later on, she always identifies herself with a nation. That becomes extremely important later on, after they get rid of Haman, and they have to change they have to do something about the original decree. When she says, "How can I stand by and watch my nation, the evil that will befall my nation?" She makes it clear that she identifies wholeheartedly with our nation. "For we have been sold, me and my nation, to kill, to destroy, to uproot." Now she had something interesting. "But if we had been sold as slaves, to be slaves, I would have kept quiet. Because then the bother would not have been worth for the loss of the king." That's very, very interesting. She's saying the only reason I'm making this complaint is because we've been earmarked for destruction. But if we'd been earmarked for slavery, which is quite serious, then I wouldn't have complained. So what is the king, what's his reaction? He doesn't know what's going on. Like he really didn't know. And the king said to Esther Malka, "Me who's at the Asa, who? Who is this individual whose heart has led him to do this thing?" Interestingly enough, I thought that isn't he the one that had given permission for the decree? But you see, at this point in time, he's separated himself completely from Haman. He doesn't want to be associated. She knows who's behind it. She knows that he had given permission, but Esther, in presenting it, is giving him the opportunity to separate himself completely from the plan. And but there's one thing that's new over here, and this also shows the tremendous selfishness of Haman. What he finds out over here is that Haman had gone ahead and put into action a plan which would not just kill the Jews, but would kill his own wife, would kill the queen, because I'm part of this thing as well. This individual in whom you've placed your entire trust has now put into place a policy and a plan that will lead to my destruction. So he's filled with complete anger. Why did she say that if we had been sold for slaves, I'd be quiet? Why'd she make that point? Her complete loyalty, and guess what? Guess what? Haman can't be loyal. Haman tried to pretend that this was good for the king. Really? If it was good for the king, if he was doing this for purely objective reasons, then there's another way that he could have done it. He could have eliminated the power of the Jews, and at the same time, he could have enriched the kingdom. He didn't have to kill them. He could have made them into slaves. Now, many historians, in analyzing the Holocaust, have made the point that if it wasn't for the Holocaust, there's a very good argument that could be made that Germany would have won the war. Because the amount of resources and energy that they put into maintaining the Holocaust machinery that they diverted, they were so hell-bent on killing the Jews that they actually diverted needed, much needed, men, materiel, machinery, just to keep the Holocaust going. Not to mention the millions of Jews who, had they not been persecuted, would have been fighting on the side of the Germans. Not to mention the brilliant scientists like Einstein who would have been working for the other side, and they may have had the atom bomb, and they could have won the war. So the hatred for the Jew now, however, was such they couldn't even be rational about it had they treated the Jews in a different way. That's what she's saying over here. That I wouldn't have complained, because then I would have recognized that it's something beneficial to the king. But Haman didn't look at it that way. If Haman was truly concerned about the king, but he had a problem with the Jews, he wanted to put down the Jews, why did he earmark them for destruction? Why did he think about using them in a constructive kind of a way? That proves that everything that he's done for purely selfish reasons, and he's been masquerading behind the fact that it's for the good of the king. When Achashverosh heard that, he was filled with anger. He was filled with anger. And that's exactly what she wanted to evoke. A tremendous anger, which I would say the anger for two reasons. First of all, he was angry at himself. He was angry at himself that he had placed all of this faith, all of this confidence, that he'd made a huge mistake. Of course, he's not going to admit it, but he's filled with anger. But then there's another anger, I believe, and that is, it's very, very dangerous when you get involved. He realized that he'd been used. Nobody likes to be used. And what happened over here was that Haman had used him, had fooled him, had deceived him, and had used him, and the king had gone along with it. And once he recognized what was taking place, then he was filled with such anger that he left. Now what happens next is like soap drama, like a bad soap drama, soap opera, what is it called, soap opera. It's strange. So he goes into the garden. Explain this one. This always gives everybody a problem. So the king gets up in his anger from the party, and he goes into the garden to try and calm down. What happens next is something totally unpredictable. So Haman gets up, and he's completely lost his bearings to plead with Queen Esther, because he saw that the anger of the king was completely against him. And in doing so, he sort of falls upon her couch or her bed to plead with her. Innocently, it wasn't a sexual thing. And the king returns from the garden, and Haman had fallen on the bed that Esther was on, or couch. They used to eat on couches then, whatever it was. And the king said, "Do you plan to conquer the queen with me in the house?" That's the strange. Do you think that even Achashverosh, even at that moment, would come back? Does it make any sense? It's kind of bad drama. It's not believable, because whatever it is, you know that he's pleading for his life, but he sees him on the bed and he accuses him of trying to conquer the queen. It sounds like a crazy kind of a thing, even for Achashverosh, even distraught. Now, but it indicates, hagam, indeed, that's how far you're going? That's your chutzpah? See, there's two things over here. And that is to say that it's bad to get somebody angry at you. It's bad to be in a state of anger. The Rambam says, of all the different character traits, the anger is the one you should never partake of anger. A person should never get angry. Sometimes you have to show that you're angry to children or whatever. I'm not going to mention other relationships. But sometimes you have to act as though you're angry, but inwardly you're supposed to be calm. You should never lose your temper. You should never get angry, because when a person is angry, he's totally insane. He's completely insane. It's the worst emotion of all. The rabbis say it's like idolatry. Kolakoe, so whoever gets angry, it's like he's worshipping idols. And you say the craziest, and you do the stupidest, and you say the craziest things. You cause irreparable harm. If a person, any person in this room has a problem with anger, I'll meet with you later and I'll talk to you about it. Because you have to get working on it immediately. You have to work on that. Of all the midos, you really have to work on that. That's an essence of perfection. But when a person is angry, he'll distort. When somebody hates you, no matter what it is, they'll anything you do, and they'll distort it, and they'll turn it around, and they'll make it into a negative, no matter how harmless, no matter how innocent it is. If there's any shred of any kind of a connection to make a negative, they'll do it. You've all seen that happen in all situations. So in this situation, he was totally angry at him. So any connection that would make him look bad, oh, now you're in bed with her? Now you're taking her over? Even though it doesn't make any sense, he's going to use it. You made an enemy. But I want to also mention a beautiful interpretation. I believe it's from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Because the term that he uses is to conquer the queen, lichbosh es hamalka, to conquer, which is not necessarily a sexual term. In ancient times, whenever a person wanted to take over the kingship, the way he did so was by conquering the wives of the king. When you took over the wives of the king, in fact, that's what Avshalom, when Avshalom rebelled against David HaMelech, the first thing he did was to take over the king's wives. Because that was a demonstration that you're seizing power. So the expression of Agam Lichbosh es Hamalka, that are you intending, you have the nerve to take over, to conquer the queen, which means to say that he's accusing him of disloyalty, and your real intention, after all is said and done, is to get rid of me and to take over the kingdom. So that was the end. That was the end. And interestingly enough, if we've gotten this far, another hero emerges. Sometimes you become a hero by chance. You just happen to be in the right time in the right place, and you become a hero and you get written down in history books and people read about you every year. Who's that? Carvona? You never would have heard about him. Just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And we have a Gam Carvona, Zachal HaTov. We sing it every year after Shoshana Yaakov. What was Carvona? Why is he remembered? Because he sees the moment. You're dealing with Amalek. It becomes very important. So he jumps in and he says, because now everybody wants to be on the side of the winner. I don't know where Chavona was before in all of this, but you want to be on the side of the winner. Who's winning now? The Jews are winning. There's the tree. Then he guess who he planted this tree for? Now he tells them the story of the tree. It's all waiting. And who's it waiting for? It's waiting for who? For Mordechai Yehudi. And what? Asher Diber Tov Al HaMelech. The good guy. The guy that wanted to save the king. And what did the king say? Kalu Olav. Hang him right now. That's very important. Why is it very important? What's the difference if we were to put him in jail? Because it's Amalek. Because it's Amalek. If you give him a chance, if you let him escape, look around the world today, you let the person escape, you let him off the hook, you thought he was down and out, you thought we were finished with Saddam Hussein, Bush did, you thought he was finished with the guy. After that terrible, terrible pound, he's back, he's still trouble, and guess what? Bush is not the president anymore. Well, his son is, but it's a different story. That's why it's extremely important when you're dealing with Amalek, with a Russia like Haman, that he had to be killed immediately. Had he not been killed immediately, he was powerful. He still had friends. He still had allies. He could have mounted a counterattack. So the fact that Charvona stepped in and elicited that command was crucial. Because that meant that the major obstacle was gone. Of course, there's more to the story because now they had to deal with rescinding the order. That's the next part. I'm not going to take that up tonight. But the major objective of Esther succeeded brilliantly. And now you see that she wasn't just acting impulsively, but there was a brilliant strategy based upon a deep understanding of human nature, based upon an understanding of what made Ahasuerus tick, what made Haman tick, and what the essence of their relationship was, and to use all of the techniques of psychology, of suspense, of withholding information, of time, all these factors came together. So why is it so brilliant? What's so significant about the miracle? Why is the miracle of Purim so significant? More significant in a way than the miracles of Sinai. The splitting of the Red Sea, God coming down the mountain, these seem to be the greatest demonstrations of God's power, and yet there's an element of God's name is not even mentioned in the Megillah. The beauty of the Megillah and what caused the Jews to rethink Torah and to accept the Torah in a different light was precisely because they weren't overwhelming. Of course God can split a sea. Well, you're demonstrating the supreme power of God. Fine. But the miracle of Purim was a different level. It shows that in terms of living our life, that God gave us a derech hachayim, a way of life, and if we raise ourselves to a higher level, and we live in accordance with God's plans, and we utilize chachma, we utilize intelligence, and we put into motion those types of plans, then automatically God's providence naturally, it's a natural thing, it's built into the scheme of things that it naturally relates to us, and it brings those plans to fruition, so the activities of man are working hand in hand with the providence of God, and that produces the result. That's the Kiddush Hashem. That's the sanctification of God. To see that God can split a sea, so God is great. But what does that have to do with how I should live my life? Here, that's fear. That's an acceptance out of fear. Of course. But that's not love. Love is when you see that this whole Torah is a book of wisdom. It's a book which directs every aspect of life and gives you the capacity to deal with all situations. And that when you live this way, then you invoke, you have access to the divine providence, and then the situation will inevitably succeed. When they saw that this is the true way of life, then it was an ahava, a love of Torah. See, a person can't develop a love of Torah when it's imposed on them. And this is the mistake that we make, this is the mistake that Jewish education makes today, and parents make it because they try to impose, to force. And when children are young, you may have no other choice. But even then, you've got to be very, very careful. You can induce a Judaism of fear, but the real challenge is to induce a Judaism of love, and nobody will accept it out of love until he sees for himself the truth, the wisdom, the benefit, and the beauty. And that's the story of the miracle of Purim. And hopefully we should, tomorrow we begin. Purim begins with the fast of Esther. And because the essential idea is to reenact exactly what took place in those days. And the first thing that happened was the fast of Esther. And the recognition that we just have to do, that's tshuva, the fast is tshuva, to return to the true ideas of Torah, and to try and reshape our lives in accordance not just with the observance of the religion, but with the implementation of the wisdom and the beauty of Torah. Question?
There's a proof to what you're saying from the very beginning of the story, and that is that when Mordecai tells Esther that you have to go to the king, and she tells him, I don't think now is the time, he doesn't say to her, listen, this is an emergency, we're all going to be killed, and if you don't go to the king right now, we're all going to be killed. That's not what he said.
Right.
What he says to her is that if you don't go to the king right now, we're going to be held. And it isn't you who's going to do it, someone else is going to do it.
Right.
Now, that's not the way people usually address a problem like this, except that Mordechai is clearly very certain that everything is going to end well. He's telling her it's going to end well. He knows it already.
Right.
Why? Because he is going to do what has to be done in terms of doing it through Hashem's ways, and Hashem is going to come and merge with this and create the salvation. He's telling her this before the whole thing begins.
Right. So you're saying that...
And if you're not the player, someone else is going to be the player. But this is the way it's going to come down.
But you'll be lost. You'll be lost. That's an interesting point. But that's the truth. You don't tell a person to be Jewish or do this or that because others need it. In the end, it's you. It's your benefit and your loss. That your failure to act at this time, the Jews will be saved. Because that's guaranteed by God. The Jews are an indestructible people. So that's not an issue. The question is, will you meet the challenge that God has prepared for you? And if you don't, then you'll be lost. That's the point.
Well, that's the point. But he was also telling her there's going to be a miracle.
Well, I mean, as far as that's concerned, what exactly he meant by that? Revach Vatzala, he said, deliverance, salvation will come from a different place. I'm not sure if he was saying that God will save us from a miracle. Because nobody knows. Nobody can predict the exact future. He meant the Jewish people. La Yehudim. At large. The Jewish people will not be destroyed as a result. That's what he meant. He was referring to the Jewish people at large. I don't think he was saying that. But you see, sometimes, God, there is no deliverance in a particular sense. Look at the Holocaust. You couldn't say that deliverance and salvation came for the Holocaust. Not when 6 million Jews were killed. So no one can really say that. But the Jews survived. The Nazi regime is gone. The Jews survived. The Jews rebuilt the state. In many, many ways, we're in a much higher plane. from the standpoint of survival. I mean, hopefully the state will be strong and will continue to grow, but this is an unbelievable advance. So Rav Achvatzal, it can be said that on a certain level, I don't want to say it because the horror is such that it's a slap in the face to tell Jews, especially people who went through the Holocaust, that there was deliverance. On a certain level there was no deliverance, but on a certain level there was. In terms of the Jewish people as a whole, he couldn't destroy the Jews because the Jews are indestructible. Are there any other questions? Okay. Do we have a minion from Marv? All right, well, Dava Marv, everyone divided if we have a minion. We have refreshments upstairs. Tomorrow night, 7:25 Mincha, I believe. 7:25 Mincha?
No, 5:30.
I'm completely off the track. 7:25, I have no idea.
Is that McGillivray? No, Marv.